From Indiana to Florida, New Mexico to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in yet another landmark ruling, the Supreme Court of the United States has curbed the administrative power of the Environmental Protection Agency. Greg Wrightstone from the CO2 Coalition is here to discuss. State-by-state primary elections continued this week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on results from Oklahoma, Utah, Illinois, and South Carolina. California and several other states are considering using American Rescue Plan funds to send out more stimulus checks. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why that will feed the inflation beast. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling over Roe v. Wade has sent the left into Roe rage. But on his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says all the decision does is return the issue to the states. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In a blow to the radical green agenda, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, overstepped its authority in an attempt to regulate power plant greenhouse gas emissions. Greg Wrightstone is executive director of the CO2 Coalition. He joins us now to discuss the ruling. Greg, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Greg, before we get to the Supreme Court ruling, which was handed down here this past week, tell us exactly what the issue is that was at hand.
Well, the EPA, according to the Supreme Court, had overreached its authority by regulating greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide in particular from everything that emits carbon dioxide, but specifically and importantly, electricity generation from coal-fired power plants and natural gas-fired power plants. The EPA, under the Clean Air Act, back under the Obama administration, had found, it was called the endangerment finding, which was horrible. And in that finding, they found that CO2, we call it the miracle molecule, they call it the demon molecule. They determined that CO2 was a pollutant. And there's no such way is that the case. They've been regulating emissions, imposing cap and trade, carbon taxes and the like on these, and severely regulating them to death. I call it a death by a thousand regulatory cuts. And this is mainly coming from the EPA. And what the Supreme Court did this week was to say, no, things like this, when we have major decisions like this, it's called the major questions doctrine. If you have major questions, it should be imposed or decided by the legislature and not be imposed on the citizens and companies by unelected bureaucrats sitting in Washington, D.C. And creating havoc in the economic markets and in manufacturing and electricity generation. So they stepped in, and it was very clear-cut. There wasn't any mamby-pamby about it. They're saying you went way too far. If you're going to do this, it's going to have to come from the legislature. I'm fearful of what we might see in a lame duck session of Congress in terms of just really, really bad legislation. Probably they'll try and get something through the legislature declaring carbon dioxide a pollutant or some such. But right now, we're free and clear. And it looks like it's a pretty broad reach that it's not just dealing with carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions, but it might also extend to water quality regulations. We've seen coal-fired power plants being shut down, many more being shut down coming in the future because of overly harsh and restrictive water production regulation. Lemon, we see some of these coal plants that they're putting the water that's going into the rivers and streams is actually cleaner when it comes out of the plant than when it goes in. They're taking water and then introducing even cleaner water into the river. But the EPA said, oh, that's not good enough. It has to be, you know, you have to get that very last, whatever it is, part per billion out of the flow, even though the rivers are flowing into have high concentrations of what they're trying to regulate. It doesn't make sense. So it's a huge step to reining in an out-of-control regulatory administrative state.
In terms of its impact on our overall energy grid, Greg, we're already having some states, California, even Texas, mainly Western, that are saying we're going to have some rolling brownouts this summer. We want people to cut back on air conditioning. And of course, add to that the notion that we can change all of our vehicle fleet over to electricity, which we already don't have enough of. Does this really set on end this whole green energy agenda and say, hey, look, we can't just go regulate fossil fuels out of existence?
It's a big step forward. This is huge. But this is just one of many things coming down. I've been saying for a long time now, we are winning. And this is what winning looks like. But this is just a big first step towards some regulatory common sense. The other thing we see with these EVs are the prices keep going up. The dangers of lithium is being recognized. The EU just is considering, it looks like they may do it next week, is regulating imports of lithium into the European Union. And there's also real concerns about exporting electric vehicles from Europe into the United States. We've seen recent ship fires probably from lithium batteries that spontaneously combusted. We know that big container ship. The insurance industry is taking a hard look at whether they even will insure these type of vehicles and to be transported in the ships. So there's just a whole string of things, and the expensiveness, the costs of these EVs keep going up because of the rare earth minerals, the cobalt, the copper. They're all escalating greatly. What we haven't seen too, anybody listening to this show that heats their home with natural gas, just you wait and see this winter when you get that first cold weather bill. Natural gas prices have also skyrocketed, but most people don't normally recognize that until the heating season is upon them. So that'll be another shock. And what we're seeing, I've got a commentary I'm writing now on energy poverty in America. And we talk a lot about energy poverty in the developing world of Africa and India. But we're seeing it here in the United States with this increasing cost for energy. And energy taxes, increases in energy costs are really a regressive taxation scheme. And by that, I mean it affects the poorest the most. A progressive tax, of course, would go after the highest payers. But a regressive tax, like increasing energy costs, the poorest and those on fixed incomes spend the highest percentage of their income on energy as any other group. So they're really punishing the people they claim to help.
We'll continue to follow all of these issues with Greg Wrightstone, the executive director of the CO2 Coalition. Greg, tell us a bit about CO2 Coalition. Where can folks also go on the web to learn more about this ruling from the Supreme Court as well as other issues?
Well, we're nearly 100 of the top scientists, physicists, I'm a geologist, experts dealing with climate change. We're climate realists and see that the Earth's ecosystems are thriving and prospering because of modest warming and increasing CO2. We've got a new education initiative that I'm very excited about. We can talk about it in a later date. To learn more, go to co2coalition.org. That's co2coalition.org.
Greg Wrightstone of the CO2 Coalition. Greg, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you so much, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the offices of the Club for Growth. We continue to keep an eye on state-by-state primaries taking place all over America this spring and summer. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks.
We will begin in Oklahoma, where there is an open U.S. Senate seat as U.S. Senator Jim Inhofe retired. How is it that we come about having a special election for a U.S. Senate seat, Scott, and what's happening there?
Yeah, Oklahoma is one of those really weird states where the governor actually doesn't appoint a replacement, but you have a special election for the United States Senate. Inhofe announced that he's going to retire at the end of 2022, so it created this potential vacancy, and they went ahead with the special election. The top two finishers are going to advance to a runoff on August 23rd. The first place finisher with over 40% was Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen, and in second place was the former Speaker of the State Legislature, a guy named T.W. Shannon, and he got about 17%. This was a pretty loaded primary with a bunch of different candidates. Inhofe's former Chief of Staff, Luke Holland, took fourth place. You had a state senator named Nathan Dom, and he was supported by Rand Paul. He took third place with about 11% of the vote. And then former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt took fifth place with roughly 5% of the vote. So Oklahoma is going to be going forward here. Obviously, with Mark Wayne Mullen finishing in the mid-40s, he would be the favorite to win that special election runoff race in August. But you shouldn't count out T.W. Shannon, and obviously there's about 8 weeks left to create a contrast for each of these candidates and figure out who Oklahomans want to send to the United States Senate to fill this Inhofe vacancy.
And a primary this past week also in Utah?
Senator Mike Lee fended off a couple of challengers, and he advances to the general election. Senator Lee has been a champion for Club for Growth over his decade in the United States Senate. One thing to keep in mind is he's up against Evan McMullen, and the Democrats in Utah decided not to nominate anybody and instead throw all of their political power behind a so-called independent. You guys might remember Evan McMullen ran for president in the 2016 presidential election as an independent. He's a former Capitol Hill staffer, and the bottom line is that there's a lot of different dynamics in Utah when it comes to conservatism and the establishment with sort of like the Romney wing and how Mormons use their political influence. Obviously, both Evan McMullen and Mike Lee are LDS, but the race in November is going to tighten, and it's going to be competitive in what is a really bright red state. So Club for Growth is all in for Mike Lee through Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action. We look forward to helping him win.
And in Illinois, we had a key race for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives.
This was one of those races where two incumbent representatives were paired up against each other following reapportionment and redistricting in Illinois. So you had Congressman Rodney Davis against Congresswoman Mary Miller. Mary Miller is supported by President Donald Trump, and obviously Rodney Davis had a couple of bad votes that were perceived to be anti-Trump. Trump came in there and did a rally last Saturday, and ultimately what we saw here was Mary Miller cleaning up by almost 15%, 57.2 to 42.8% in this member versus member primary. Club for Growth PAC endorsed her, and we spent several million dollars in this race helping educate voters on the record of Rodney Davis. I think Mary Miller is going to be a fantastic representative for a long time. And this race is also important because Club for Growth Action and Club for Growth PAC are now 2-for-2 in the member versus member primary races, having previously helped Alex Mooney defeat David McKinley in West Virginia.
And in a somewhat unusual, maybe even a groundbreaking move, Club for Growth got involved in a statewide race in South Carolina. What was at play there, Scott?
Club for Growth has set up a affiliated super PAC called School Freedom Fund, and it's another way that we can continue to promote and advocate for school freedom and school choice. In this race, we had former state director for Senator Jim DeMint, and she was also a Club for Growth Foundation fellow named Ellen Weaver, and she faced off against a teachers union boss named Kathy Manis in the South Carolina Superintendent of Education primary runoff this week. We obviously decided that this was a pretty easy contrast, somebody that totally supports school choice against somebody that is really a teachers union boss. And so how do you think the voters decided on this one? Well, it was about 64% to 36%, and Ellen Weaver easily won that race.
And we would be remiss as we head into the month of July here not to reflect back on the close of the Supreme Court of the United States recent term. There were a flurry of really landmark and major decisions that were handed down. Scott, what impact do you see all this as having on both the Biden administration and on the upcoming elections?
Well, the bottom line is that it's too early to say, but we certainly think that it can build enthusiasm for the pro-life community who has been working for 50 years to reverse Roe v. Wade, and that was accomplished because of the three Supreme Court justices that were confirmed by a Republican Senate during President Trump's time in office. Obviously, Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, and Brett Kavanaugh helped swing the majority to 6-3, And that was a big, big, important case. I think looking forward, it also becomes one of these issues that we have to figure out, is there going to be federal funding for abortion? This week we've had not only the radicals like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calling for federal lands to set up tents to provide abortion services, but we've had the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Javier Becerra, even saying this week that they're considering setting up abortion providers on federal lands in red states. This, we think, would be a violation not only of the Hyde Amendment, but also a violation of what the court intent was in terms of the federal government getting involved with abortion. And so unless there is actual legislation and statute signed into law, and that would be subject to the legislative filibuster right now, we don't think that federal funding should go forward. So that's going to become a real fight in September as we look at whether we're going to do a continuing resolution and punt everything into December, or if we're going to have another one of those so-called federal government shutdowns.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
States are flush with COVID-19 relief money, and some are actually having a hard time spending it. Several states are sending out more stimulus checks, which, of course, will further fuel inflation. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
In California, the latest plan to combat inflation involves flooding the state with more free money in the form of stimulus checks from the state capitol. Yeah, that ought to do the trick. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a look at California's somewhat cockamamie plan to battle inflation by dumping more money into residents' wallets. While it might seem like a nice thing to get an extra stimulus check, that's, of course, not going to help bring prices down. If anything, it's going to send them in the other direction. And it's not just California that is making this mistake. Of course, states from coast to coast are flush with lots of extra cash thanks to that government bailout that that many states got as part of the American Rescue Plan. And there's a lot of excess money left over that has yet to trickle its way into economies. And all of that, of course, is just more bad news when it comes to inflation. But what is happening in California on Sunday night? Governor Gavin Newsom, he's a Democrat, of course, but you already knew that. He announced that he and the leaders of the state legislature had agreed to a budget deal that would send what he calls inflation relief checks of up to $1,050 to 23 million residents of the state. He says that California's budget will address many of the state's most pressing needs and prioritizes getting dollars back into the pockets of millions of Californians who are grappling with global inflation and rising prices of just about everything from gas to groceries. That's a nice sentiment, but it seems like he either never took or failed his basic economics class. Every taxpayer in the state earning less than $75,000 and couples that making less than $150,000 are due to receive a $350 check plus another $350 check if they have children. That's according to CBS News. A married couple with children would qualify for a maximum of up to $1,050. And then the amount of money tapers off for higher income people above that $150,000 threshold. It should almost go without saying, of course, as my colleague Christian Britschke writes this week at Reason.com, that giving out individual stimulus checks is more likely to exacerbate inflation than to cure it. The $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan passed in March of 2021 is largely credited with having made inflation significantly worse. The Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, in one analysis, says that it may have raised inflation by about 3 percentage points. The rising prices that those checks are intended to address also mean that much of this stimulus money will be spent, which means that it will only be dumping more money into the economy, chasing the same number of goods, increasing demand, and therefore likely increasing prices as well. And that's particularly true given that it's lower income households that are going to be getting most of these stimulus checks. And those same households, of course, are more apt to spend their additional dollars rather than save them just by their very nature of being low income households in the first place. But while the checks will not really do anything to fix the fundamental mismatch in the economy right now, supply chain issues or underlying monetary policy that's really driving inflation, one thing they will do, of course, is just give people more money to spend on the same amount of goods, which is a recipe for making inflation worse. Now, one reason that California has to spend some of this money, or one reason that California has decided to spend some of this money on inflation relief checks, is because in some ways it has to. It has to find some way to get rid of that giant surplus that the state is currently carrying. The state's constitution actually caps per capita spending growth at particular levels, and it requires that surpluses get either returned to taxpayers or spent on education or redirected to certain types of spending projects, things like infrastructure. And this is generally a pretty good rule. It's a rule that prevents politicians from just dumping surpluses into some sort of slush fund or holding it year after year after year when it could be put to productive use. But while that explains why California is handing out stimulus checks, it's not just California that's making that decision with the extra money that the state has right now. In Georgia, Governor Brian Kemp recently approved payments of up to $500 to households because of the money that that state has gotten from the federal government as part of the pandemic relief. Hawaii residents who earn less than $100,000 could qualify for payments of up to $300, meaning that a family of four could get $1,200 as part of its own relief program. In New Jersey, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, New Mexico, New York, and Virginia, there are various forms of stimulus programs that have been approved by governors and legislatures. In some cases, that means checks to people. In other cases, it means tax rebates. All of that is according to a report from Fatherly, a family magazine. But all of this is really just more evidence that state governments didn't need this aid in the first place. A few weeks ago on this very program, I talked about how state and local governments have blown a good chunk of the money that they got through the American Rescue Plan on things like upgrades to public golf courses and bonuses for government workers, items that, of course, have nothing to do with COVID-19 or public health. Then, as now, I pointed out that the fault lies in significant part with Congress, which authorized more than $800 billion in stimulus funds for states and local governments without putting much in the way of restrictions on how that money could be spent. All things considered, these stimulus checks are basically a terrible solution to inflation, although you could at least argue that they might be better off than some alternatives because they're putting money in the hands of individuals to spend. And the alternative is that politicians would decide where the money goes. So in some regard, this is maybe the best possible outcome. Since we can't go back and undo the stimulus program, we can't go back and take that money out of state governments, at least distributing it back to the taxpayers is better than nothing. But the bigger problem here, the moral hazard here, I think, as we go forward out of the pandemic and hopefully eventually get inflation under control, is that politicians learned a dangerous lesson over the last few years, and that is that free money is incredibly popular with voters, and they're having a hard time of letting go of that despite the obvious consequences that we're all feeling right now. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. You can check out more of our coverage of inflation, of everything going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country. Check out Christian Britschke's piece on this particular topic as well this week at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In overturning Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court of the United States ended a so-called right that never actually existed. Now the states must decide abortion policy. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The Supreme Court's recent Dobbs v. Jackson decision overturning Roe v. Wade is one of the most consequential decisions we will see in our lifetimes, just as the original Roe decision was. A similarly consequential Supreme Court decision was the Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954, that overturned the Plessy v. Ferguson decision that created the separate but equal policy for education. The ruling in Brown led to the desegregation of public schools. Note that each reversed a precedent decision. In criticizing the Dobbs decision, the left presents the doctrine of stare decisis as if it were some kind of constitutional golden rule. Stare decisis is the doctrine that courts should adhere to precedent in making their decisions. The words mean to stand by things decided in Latin, or in even plainer English, that decisions of the court should stay decided. Yet you'll never find anyone on the left, and maybe even on the right, arguing that violating stare decisis was wrong in the Brown decision. The proper application of stare decisis is to respect precedent, but not be inextricably bound by it when the court finds that an earlier precedent was wrongly decided. That's a high standard, but it can be met, and I would argue that in the case of Dobbs, it was met, and that therefore Roe should be reversed. As in the case of many of the most consequential Supreme Court decisions, Roe and Dobbs are both about a right. There are many different kinds of rights, some of which are guaranteed by the Constitution, and many more that are not, but are codified in legislation or limited by legislation. Constitutional rights, on the other hand, have a unique and narrow purpose. They are shielded from legislative prohibition in the United States. In other words, no legislation can be enacted in this country that would have the effect of denying such a right. The Dobbs case was about whether or not a state could enact a law prohibiting abortion after a certain number of weeks of fetal gestation. While it may be perfectly understandable that people who believe that they have been given a right may become upset if that right is later taken away from them, the constitutional matter at issue is less emotional and more logical. Whether a constitutional right to abortion was properly established by Roe. The emotional outrage that opponents of Dobbs are now expressing has given rise to a rhetorical term coined in the last week called Roe Rage. I want to suggest to the listeners of American Radio Journal that the decision isn't worth the hysteria that dominates most of the media coverage of it. The Supreme Court simply restored the principle that abortion can be codified and legally protected or limited or prohibited altogether on a state-by-state basis. States in which public opinion favors permitting the practice can enact laws that protect it. States in which it is not supported by public opinion can enact laws to ban or limit it now, and they can repeal the ban or limitation sometime later if public opinion shifts in favor of permitting the practice. All that the Dobbs decision did was to state the obvious, that abortion is not an enumerated right in the Constitution, and further, that it cannot be honestly deduced as an implied right. Roe's claim that it is an implied right, deduced from another implied but not enumerated right, a broad right to privacy, was always a shaky proposition at best, and the court concluded that it was erroneous. Abortion rights supporters should now turn their attention to creating permissive and protective state legislation, but I doubt that they will pass up the opportunity to demagogue the issue into concerted vilification of all Republicans as anti-woman. That's probably irresistible as a strategy as we approach the 2022 midterm elections that will determine the makeup of the House and Senate for the next 2 years, and it is the last thing that our already divided nation needs at this time. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJPH-FM in Woodbine, New Jersey, KSOO-AM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, along with WBFD-AM in Bedford, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.